It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin's DNR wants to shake up the way it tackles invasive species in the state.
First, as President Obama's second term in office continues, our guest says 5 years in, America's gotten a man who came to the White House with a curiously blank slate, a penchant for magical thinking, and a distaste for confrontation.
The result, according to David Bromwich, a presidency that's never been able to leave the ground.
David Bromwich joins us now. He's Sterling Professor of English at Yale and the author of the piece The Voice, How Obama Became a Publicist for His Presidency Rather Than the President, which ran recently in Tom Dispatch. David, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Well, you say that Barack Obama is ruling more like a king than a president. How so?
I mean by that not what some protesters against his presidency would mean. People on the far right, such as the Tea Party, who often refer to him as a tyrant or some sort of absolute monarch. But I mean a king in the sense of someone in a rather weak and ceremonial position in a mixed constitutional government who can make certain decisions completely on his own, does not confer or collaborate with the assembly, with the legislative part of the government, and who sees it as part of his situation to appear often in public, offer glamour by the opportunity of exposure to himself, and to be a sort of ambassador for the spirit of the nation rather than an efficient officer within it. So, you know, the emphasis is on taking the presidency to be a rather a dignified position and not especially an efficient one. That distinction, by the way, comes from a book on the English Constitution by Walter Badgett, a conservative of the mid-19th century, but I think it's just right for application to his case. It somewhat would apply to, I think, the way Ronald Reagan took the presidency as well.
Do you have reason to think that this is how President Obama sees himself, as sort of this magisterial, benevolent monarch rather than someone who is sort of leading the charge?
Yeah, I think it's how he does see himself now, rather consciously so, after the first year in office following his reelection, when he's working against the obstacle of a Republican majority in both houses of Congress, and where his only significant piece of legislation that there was any thought of passage for, which is on immigration, is now pretty well stalled. Nevertheless, he goes around states, from state to state, making speeches about the need for a raise in the minimum wage. He goes on tours of foreign countries, not always very substantive as far as one can see, but this penchant for travel and for exposure of his views domestically as well has been a large part of his presidency from the beginning. I cited in the article you mentioned about Obama wanting to become a certain kind of leader and becoming a different kind, statistics compiled by Mark Noller, the CBS correspondent, about the numbers of small, medium-sized, and large speeches that he had given in the first 4 years of his presidency, his first term, and it's upwards of 1,800. Now, Noller doesn't give any comparative figure on previous presidents, but my bet would be that's a high figure, probably unrivaled in previous presidencies.
Well, and it may be that that has always been part of what has drawn people to Barack Obama, is that he is hyper-articulate. His words have oftentimes soared, and it's the sort of thing that drew especially Democrats to his banner. Yep. Isn't that part of what you would want in a president as well, someone who is well-spoken and who could articulate the message to the people?
You want, I think, someone ideally, and I don't claim to know the name of a candidate or elected person who perfectly fulfilled this. You want someone who can be inspirational, articulate, can have, as you say, an exciting effect through soaring words, but also someone who can explain in an on-the-ground sort of pedestrian way the logic of a policy, and finally someone who can convince members of the legislative branch to go along with him, and whether through persuasive influence or compromise, pass quite a lot of the legislation that he and his party want. As I see Obama, he has that power of inspiring or exciting people. He has it less and less, but he had it in extraordinary measure in 2008 and to a lesser extent in the years following. I think people felt that had reached a definite point of diminishing returns when they were able to compare the 2012 convention speech at the Democratic convention by Bill Clinton with a speech by Obama. And it was remarked by a lot of observers at the time how masterly and, full of momentum and argumentative energy Clinton's speech was, and how rather pale and just typical, characteristic, and boilerplate Obama's speech was. So just talking, when you're doing quite a lot of it, even talking in an inspirational way and speaking words that people want to hear, isn't really enough. And the other trouble with Obama has been the disparity, very visible, between his talk, his words, and his actions.
Yeah, I want to get at that a little bit. Yep. Because you say that, you were talking about his eloquence when he speaks, and that was part of what elected him. He also seemed reasonable. He said he wouldn't play partisan politics. But you say that underneath that, he simply doesn't have strong convictions. So he doesn't have not only the courage of convictions, he doesn't have the convictions themselves. Lay out that case for us.
Well, what is conviction? It's a belief. And under the belief, strong a support for the belief that you would do quite a lot to make it come true. You would even sacrifice some of your popularity. You would even take risks, perhaps even physical risks, certainly political risks. And I think that this sort of political courage, to call it that, is what people have felt was missing in Obama. From early on, I'll mention three instances just from 2009 and two from early 2010. In 2009, he made as one of his first pledges of the presidency the promise to close Guantanamo, and he assigned the White House counsel, Greg Craig, to be in charge of that, a turf war, as they called it, developed between Greg Craig and the chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, which Emanuel won, and the theory was that people aren't interested in closing Guantanamo. And that effort pretty much trailed away, ending in the sacking of Greg Craig, and no more talk about closing Guantanamo. It's a matter of record that Obama himself took almost no interest in any of the details about closing Guantanamo, never pursued the subject. He left it as a sort of commandment, that is to say, words that sound like convictions, and then left it for his people to argue out. The thing trailed off, no action. A second was the promise of his campaign to take care of national security in a way that would not seem to emulate the policies of Dick Cheney. That is to say, massive surveillance and changes in the whole approach to civil liberties that Americans associate with the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments to the Bill of Rights. He gave the National Archives speech in May of 2009, following quite a lot of pressure from Cheney particularly, who was active at that moment, and others, saying that Obama, by publishing the records of CIA abuses, he published a first set of them before he suppressed a second set, was endangering the country. That was the speech in which Obama pretty much conceded the substance of Cheney's architecture for national security following 2001, and said that there would, in fact, remain a category of permanent detainees for the length of a war on terror, which, though Obama didn't call it the war on terror, he did call a war. And the policies of secrecy in contest in court cases have invoked much the same state secrets privilege that Bush and Cheney relied on, but to an even greater extent than Bush and Cheney. And then in the end of 2009, after a long examination of the possibilities in Afghanistan, Obama decided to add 33,000 troops to escalate the war there and follow the surge plan in a modified form that was said to have worked in Iraq in 2007. That is to say, he followed the generals Petraeus and McChrystal. He had a good opportunity from supporters such as Doug Lute, who was actually a Bush holdover, from James Cartwright, the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who was extremely opposed to any escalation in Iraq, from the ambassador from the ambassador to Afghanistan, Carl Eikenberry, and from Joe Biden, who was for beginning a pullout right then. But he went the other way. Hillary Clinton sided with the generals, and that made it harder for him. But again, a different kind of president, one might think. And if you want an example, take JFK in his third year. He had an uphill battle against much fiercer military opposition to the Test Ban Treaty, but he pushed it through at considerable risk, taking considerable courage.
And that's part of your case in point here. You say that President Obama does not like to fight. He has a distaste for conflict. We're talking right now with David Bromwich. Bromwich is a professor of English at Yale University and the author of an article that says President Obama became a publicist for his own presidency rather than the president. He says Obama has failed to lead 5 years in. Well, what do you think?
Let us know your thoughts. Is the Obama presidency a disappointment to you? Were there indications for Democrats or critiques from Republicans that troubled you early on and have come into play since then? If you voted for President Obama, did you get what you expected? Has he talked too much, led too little? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We're talking with David Bromwich right now. Bromwich is Sterling Professor of English at Yale University. He's the author of a recent article that says President Obama became a publicist for his own presidency rather than the president, that he's failed to lead, and the presidency, in essence, hasn't ever come off the ground. We want to know what you think.
Join in at 800-642-1234. Is the Obama presidency a disappointment to you? Did you vote for him? Did you get what you expected? Or are you saying, I told you so now? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or email talk@WPR.org.
And let's go to our callers right now. We have Gene on the line in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Gene.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I just caught the beginning of the program, I guess, and wanted to point out that President Obama, his background is a community organizer, which really means that you do things where all people are working together cooperatively. That's really how he's run his office. That's not what's effective in a corporate, malicious environment that the House has created. But he has done a wonderful job of acting the part of a cooperative person if the House would cooperate.
No, all right.
They haven't.
Well, thank you much for that call and those thoughts, Gene. And David, labor groups, community organizers, environmental groups, these are groups that helped propel Barack Obama into office. What has happened to his relationships with these groups, as you see it, since he came into office?
Well, all of those groups are a good deal more critical of him than they began by being, and all feel that their hopes have been disappointed. He's backing a minimum wage, though not as high as organized labor would like. We're still awaiting his decision on the Keystone XL pipeline, but I think in other respects, the failure of any sort of international treaty on global warming, a failure as pronounced in this administration as it was under Bush and Cheney, has been a tremendous letdown for environmental groups concerned about global warming. And his, as he calls it, all of the above energy policy, which includes sort of ecumenically nuclear power, deep sea drilling, Arctic drilling, fracking, along with the sunshine alternatives, panels for solar energy and wind farms. I mean, it's a very noncommittal. It's the equivalent, if you like, of a bipartisan, nonpartisan stance on energy, but it is too late for that. It's too late for the planet for that. I should say the very idea of being nonpartisan or bipartisan strikes me as a fallacy from the very first. We're in a party system, and Obama was the Democratic candidate. I worked for him. I voted for him twice. I worked for him once. You know, it was the job of the leader of the Democratic Party to take the stand that he fought with, the banner that he carried. But he does think of himself, this is a commonplace now, I think, but it's one of the things I said early on. He thinks of himself as in some ways above politics, and politics as degrading to the kind of job of inspirational unification he sees himself responsible for.
All right, let's go on to another phone call now, and we'll take Gary with us in Fitchburg. Hi, Gary.
Hi, I was very skeptical about Obama during the election when he got very much a free pass by the mainstream media. And then shortly after his inauguration, he manipulated the Democratic Party away from single-payer health care. And in my opinion, he was installed by the elite to degrade the progressive movement and create problems for the progressives in the Democratic Party. He's often given a winning hand, and he often plays it very badly. So I'm very distrustful. He's more like a Republican than a Democrat.
All right. Well, thank you for your thoughts, Gary. And that last comment, David, about getting a winning hand and playing it badly, you talk some about that in your piece. What would you say to that?
Well, I think it's been observed also by others, and I pretty much agree with the drift of that caller, that Obama begins negotiations by conceding everything that he thinks the other side might reasonably ask. So he comes the sort of rational halfway at the beginning because he has a real distaste for bargaining. This goes against most people's idea of what a community organizer is or is trained to do. But in fact, as Obama worked in community organizing, he was considered someone at the extreme of non-confrontational, of wanting to begin every process of negotiation by depolarizing and by bringing the largest powers into the negotiations right at the start. That was much the path he followed in negotiations on affordable health care, and it's been the pattern he's followed elsewhere. So, yeah, I think it is a problem of temperament, and it's a problem of his non-political understanding of politics.
All right, let's try to get one more call in here. John joins us now from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hi. I agree 100%. I did vote for him twice, and I thought he was doing the right thing. I thought he should have spent twice as much on the bailouts than he did, and he didn't, and it got us halfway out of it, like we are. However, when I voted for him the second time around, I was hoping as a lame duck with nothing to lose, he would put more on the line and put it out there and fight. And he's just rolls over, just like you said. He could be doing all sorts of things. He's got nothing to lose. And he's looking to, I guess, get somebody, another Democrat elected. I don't know what he's doing.
All right, John, thanks for your thoughts and thanks for calling in. And David, I want to have you address John's comment, and maybe you could do it through the lens of the way you see his handling of the Affordable Care Act, his signature law, as sort of evidence of what seems to be to you a hands-off approach. What happened?
Well, that seems to me also the key to the fact that Obama looks like the lamest of lame ducks now. In the first 2 years of a second term, which lasts 4 years, you're supposed to be able to do something, perhaps. His hopes for doing anything on immigration and perhaps other matters that are of concern to him, too, including some amelioration of environmental policy, that was harmed very badly by the exposure of the shoddiness of the rollout of the Affordable Care system. He entrusted it to Kathleen Sebelius, and we have it on the record now from a Politico story that I cite in the article, which hasn't been denied by anyone in the White House, that though he met with Sebelius in company a few times, since Obama has very few meetings with his cabinet, he did not meet with her one-on-one a single time in the 3 years between signing that bill and the rollout of the system itself. Now, that's more than hands-off. I think the word that applies most truly to it is dissociation. There is a kind of dissociated quality in the president's relationship to his own policies. Some of the policies are good, and for those of us who believe in those policies, it's even more hurtful that this sort of engagement has been missing all along.
And David, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been good to talk to you.
We've been talking to David Bromwich, Sterling Professor of English at Yale University, author of the book Moral Imagination, and we've been talking about his recent piece in Tom Dispatch about Barack Obama.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll get a preview of next month's issue of Discover Magazine, which hits shelves tomorrow. We'll tackle the top science news from the issue, including a cancer infecting Tasmanian devil populations and a sci-fi summer movie preview.
First, Wisconsin wildlife officials want to give the state's invasive species list its first ever overhaul. The changes would relax restrictions on the emerald ash borer, but toughen standards for other plants and animals on the list.
Terrell Hyde is with us. She's a conservation biologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Terrell, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks.
Well, let's start out by taking a look at what might change now with in regards to invasive species. What's changed?
Well, the invasive species rule, which is Wisconsin's chapter NR40, which was first put into place in 2004, is receiving its first revision since its creation. So we're adding new species to their two regulated categories in the rule, and we're improving language to help with compliance and updating scientific names of species.
Now, to get a sort of 101 on invasive species, what is the definition of that?
Well, as defined in Wisconsin statutes, invasive species are non-indigenous species whose introduction causes or is likely to cause economic or environmental harm or harm to human health.
And why is it so important that we keep track of these plants and animals that could cause harm?
Because, like in the definition, they have the ability to cause great economic or environmental harm to species that were listed in the original rule, zebra mussels, we have in the state, and there has been significant economic hardship to Wisconsinites.
And why do wildlife officials want to change the list? What's changed that now is the right time to shift things up a bit?
Well, in 2004, when the original list was created, we listed species whose invasiveness was significant or species that were in the region but not quite in Wisconsin, and they were not they would not have any impact to regulated industries. And it was understood at that point that there would be a revision in the future to look at species that we already have in, say, the nursery industry, where we would need to involve those impacted entities to a greater degree.
Now, one change that seems significant regards the emerald ash borer. That used to be something, if people found it, they had to destroy it. What is the new policy?
Okay, well, in the invasive species rule, we identify and classify invasive species into two different categories. There is a prohibited category, which those species are species that aren't in the state or don't have established populations. They have high potential for environmental impacts, and it's still feasible to eradicate and prevent their spread in the state. Examples are kudzu, feral hogs. Restricted species is the other regulated category, and those species are species that are already in the state. They have high environmental impacts, but their complete eradication is unlikely. So the emerald ash borer in 2004, when it was listed as a prohibited species. That species has now spread to 19 counties. So it no longer meets the definition of prohibited. So it's just a reclassification of the species into the restricted category. We're now looking at not eradicating this, but trying to slow and prevent its spread to other parts in the state.
So does that kind of mean we've lost the battle with the emerald ash borer and we have to sort of re-strategize?
I think there's a recognition that it's here. And so we need to put our efforts in not trying to eradicate it, but trying to control it.
Well, what are some of the other proposed changes here?
Well, there are 84 new species that are being added to the list. Some of these species people might recognize, Nutria, while we don't have them in the state. They are listed federally in neighboring states.
They look like muskrats.
They do. They
right?
do.
Are they water-dwelling rodents just
they
like muskrats?
They are. They burrow under and through water control structures like levees and dikes, and they could cause significant damage, causing flooding.
I see. So muskrats don't do that, but nutria do. And I understand there are also some shrubs that are commonly sold in a lot of nurseries that may be showing up on this list.
Yeah. So through this development, this is a very long process. In 2012, the Wisconsin Council on Invasive Species charged the department with starting this process, and they convened species assessment groups to look at over 200 species and recommend them to different, if they fit the two regulated categories. And so we've taken that through the rule process, where 84 species are initially being recommended to one of those two categories. And at this step in the rulemaking process, we are preparing to go out for public hearings. So we're still very early in the rulemaking process. And we're adding new species. We're improving clarification. One of the species assessment groups looked at those shrub species, and there are two species that come to mind as being prevalent in the nursery industry, and that's Japanese barberry and burning bush. And through the process, many people have those plants in their backyards, and that through that process in involving the stakeholders, the regulated industry, that it was recognized that there are certain cultivars of those two species that aren't as invasive, whether they don't spread vegetatively or they don't produce as much seed. And therefore, in proposing to list those two species, the department, the Wisconsin Invasive Species Council, the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection has listed specific cultivar exemptions.
Okay, so that
species
could temper that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that a hearing is in the works. Is the next step after that, once you've got everything finalized, to get the public on board and educate them about what the new things are on the list and what to look out for?
I think public education has always been a part of this. The Wisconsin Invasive Species Council is composed of people in the regulated industry, businesses, individuals. And through that process, species assessment groups, which are composed of non-agency folks, as well as agency folks, looked at each of these species recommended. Last spring, there were public hearing sessions on that initial recommended list before we even proposed them through the rulemaking process. There have been lots of mailings, and I think the importance of that is that it's engaging and educating and informing people on slowing the spread of these invasive species is a good thing. And yes, we have public hearings that are coming up, and there are many steps along the way for people to provide input and let us know how they'll be impacted.
Well, Terrell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Veronica.
That was Terrell Hyde, conservation biologist with the Wisconsin DNR. She was with us to talk about proposed changes to Wisconsin's invasive species list.
Tomorrow, another issue of Discover Magazine hits shelves. We have one of the editors here to give us a sneak peek at some of the most interesting stories in the upcoming issue.
Gemma Tarlak is a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hi, great to be with you again.
Let's start by talking about something that's getting press for a while, the story of the Tasmanian devil cancer, which has been kind of baffling scientists and decimating the devil population in Tasmania for a long time. Catch us up. What's happening there?
Well, you know, it's been a tragic just about 14 years since they've been studying it, and the cancer's been around, as far as we know, for about 20 years. I have to preface this by saying I have a thing for Tasmanian devils.
They're adorable.
I adore them.
Yeah, I was surprised. I mean, the cancer is incredibly disfiguring, but the animals are really cute.
And they're sweet. You know, I actually spent several weeks in Tasmania a few years ago and got to go to all the sanctuaries where they're trying to create this sort of reserve insurance population in case all the wild ones are wiped out. And they're just the sweetest, most timid, you know, they're like a frightened little dog, like a little Boston Terrier, and they just make funny noises sometimes. But anyway, so this cancer has been baffling them because it is a contagious cancer, and that is extremely rare. There's only one other known contagious cancer, and that infects dogs. But they couldn't figure out how exactly this cancer was moving so rapidly from one devil to another. And they finally settled upon the fact that the proteins on the cell, you know, when you think about a cell, it's kind of got all these proteins on top that tells other cells in the neighborhood basically what it is. And sometimes those proteins tell your immune system, hey, this shouldn't be here, and your immune system fights it off. Well, these particular cells in this Tasmanian devil cancer, they hide some of their proteins. And it's kind of a remarkable science going into it, way, way too detailed to sum up here in a couple minutes. But they figured out that it's hiding the proteins, so the cell enters the new victim's bloodstream, enters their body, and it's not recognized as being foreign. The body treats it as its own, as one of its own cells. So it's very scary, but at the same time, the fact that they're making strides in this research means that they may be able to save the devils and sort it out and advance cancer research, too, at the same time.
Well, now that they've figured it out, it's a stealth cell, in effect.
Yeah.
Is that pointing toward the kind of research they need to do to try to stop it?
You know, what they're trying to do is figure out a way that the cancer and the devil can coexist, because they looked at something like a vaccination program, and that's just not feasible, because they would have to go into the wild and find these very reclusive animals and not only vaccinate them, but then vaccinate their offspring, because the offspring wouldn't inherit the immunity. So they're trying to find ways to help the cancer evolve more quickly. It may sound counterintuitive, like, why do we want to help the cancer? But right now, the cancer is too deadly for its own good. You know, ideally, this is kind of a parasitic cancer, to use the term parasite loosely, but it's basically feeding off the animals as it infects each one. And they're trying to figure out a way to make the cancer less deadly, which would make the cancer more likely to survive, because the animal it's infecting are going to live longer. But at the same time, those animals are going to live longer. So they're trying to, I guess, broker a peace deal is one way of putting it, between the devils and this contagious cancer.
Now, you said the cancer's been around about 20 years, and there's some optimism now about understanding the cancer better. But can you tell us a little bit about what the population has done over those past 20 years?
Oh, my gosh. In some areas, the population has fallen by 90%. Other areas, they're doing a little bit better. About only 30 to 45% of the population has been lost, but the cancer is still spreading. So, you know, I can remember even when I was there in 2011, the researchers I talked to were very sort of pessimistic and thinking that creating these insurance populations on in sanctuaries and also on remote islands might be the only way to save the devils. But now they're actually more optimistic, and they're thinking, we saw the rates really dropping, but we think they may have bottomed out, because the devils that have not been infected may actually be, you know, have a kind of resistance to the cancer. And that it's not just that they haven't come in contact with the cancer. Maybe they've already come in contact with it, but maybe it has not infected them.
And this is a region of the world where we've lost a lot of mammal species in recorded history, right?
Yeah, yeah. Australia, I believe, leads the world in the dubious honor of having the most mammal extinctions known. And Tasmania is a special case. It's a little island off the south coast of Australia. And it's, in a lot of ways, kind of an ark, if you want to think of it, for other species that have gone extinct on the Australian mainland. And it's very secluded. There's a really nasty stretch of water between the mainland and Tasmania that makes it difficult for a lot of kind of cross-species populations. But they're surviving, and the Tasmanian devils, which were once on the Australian mainland, went extinct there 5,000 years ago, and their last toehold in the world is on Tasmania. So.
Well, it's encouraging to know that there might be some bright light at the end of the tunnel as they move forward with that.
Yeah, yeah, and, you know, just the fact that all of the researchers are optimistic gives me hope, because, you know, usually you get a mix like, oh, I don't know if this is going to work, but they're all saying, yeah, we think we're narrowing down how to deal with this.
Well, another one of this month's features is about Hurricane Sandy. Tell us about that story.
This is a really interesting story for me personally, because I actually grew up in the New York City area. And, you know, I know how populated it is. I've seen flooding even when there wasn't a hurricane, just after a heavy rain. And the author's argument is basically Hurricane Sandy was a bad storm, yes, but the destruction it caused was pretty much a man-made disaster. And his theory, or his argument, is that New York City, greater metro area, is built on a floodplain. They've been filling in land, reclaiming it from the sea for centuries, you know, for 300 years. And when we ran the story, our photo editor did a great thing where he found a map and lined it up exactly with Google Earth maps. And you can see in lower Manhattan just the enormous chunks of land that have been reclaimed from the sea. And these were all the areas that were hardest hit when Hurricane Sandy came through. So it's kind of a provocative argument, but he really backs it up with a lot of history.
This is after Sandy. Were people talking about this before Sandy, saying, hey, we're putting ourselves at risk of flooding based on where and how we're building?
Yes, you know, this has been an ongoing conversation in the New York area, but it was really interesting, and he gets into this a little bit, that after Hurricane Sandy, you know, you had New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, Mayor at the time Michael Bloomberg, President Obama, everyone saying, oh, you know, nature, she's so awful, this is the force of Mother Nature, oh, this was a major assault by Mother Nature. Nobody reacting to Hurricane Sandy really said, well, we kind of saw this one coming. And the thing is, we still haven't learned from it. You know, Ted Steinberg, the author, mentions they're still planning on building, for example, a 26-acre real estate development. It's going to be built right in the middle of a floodplain. So that, you know, what we learn from history is that we don't learn from it, you know?
Well, do you think that there is hope on the horizon, that the argument and acknowledgement that this is a floodplain could lead in the future to different building practices, especially as maybe the East Coast starts to see more severe weather?
Right, and that's actually something else that Ted gets into in the story, that we are in just a natural cycle. Set aside climate change and all the things climate change is going to do, but we're just in a natural cycle of the warming ocean, so we can expect more and more intense storms. Plus, with climate change, we've got, you know, the ocean levels are rising, et cetera. One would hope that this would kind of sound the warning call, but it's very unclear. And in fact, the only thing that gives me hope, and I never thought I would say this, Donald Trump decided not to go forward with one of his many real estate projects because of concerns that it would get washed away in another Hurricane Sandy. Hmm. So there's a little bit of hope there.
Well, and finally, you have a little fun in this issue, previewing the summer's top science fiction movies. And speaking of nature exposing the folly of men, here's a clip of one coming out.
In 1954, we awakened something.
There's nuclear tests in the Pacific. Not tests.
They were trying to kill it.
It being Godzilla. And in this issue, you've got a flowchart to help us decide what summer sci-fi movies to see. We've got that on the Central Time Facebook page, along with a Tasmanian Devil video, by the way. How did you design this summer sci-fi flowchart?
Well, you know, there's so many of these big movies that when you watch the trailers, which is really all that's available right now, they all have the epic music and the darkly shaded characters and all the, you know, lingo, like, in a world torn apart. Yeah, you know, and so just because of the sameness of a lot of the trailers and a lot of the pitches and buildup that you get from the studios, we decided to just have some fun and let people know what's coming out and when it's coming out, but have some fun with what you might like. So, for example, as we go through the flow chart, one of the questions is, do you hate Tom Cruise? Yes, no. You know,
or do you like Men in Tights? Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone has an answer to that question, right?
What about Tom Cruise in tights?
Hmm. Ooh, that's just a mental image that's going to be, ooh.
Sorry about that.
Ooh. All right.
Yeah. Well, tell us
down and recover.
Sorry, Jem, I took you out of action. Well, tell us about some of the movies you are excited about based on your flowchart. What looks good?
Well, thanks. And I am a hardcore Godzilla fan. I love it. Loved it since I was 3 years old. And my grandpa would take me to, like, Saturday matinees that would run those chopped up American versions of the Japanese original. So I love Godzilla. The trailers I've seen for this one, it looks like they finally did justice to him. You know, it's not going to be the 1998 mess with Matthew Broderick. So I'm really excited about Godzilla. And I actually interviewed Matt Reeves, who is the director for Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, for another story I'm doing. And we chatted a little bit about both the computer-generated effects in the movie and also his approach to depicting an ape civilization. And, you know, I wasn't quite frankly really interested in seeing the movie until I talked to him. And it sounds like he did a lot of really interesting things to create this feasible ape civilization.
Hmm. Well, Gemma, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us again.
My pleasure, always.
In a world full of confusing science information, Gemma Tarlak helps us make sense of it all. She's Senior Associate Director at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us each month at about this time.
And don't forget, you can find the flowchart, which will help you figure out what summer movies you'd like to see, on our Facebook page, along with some videos of the very charismatic Tasmanian devils that Gemma Tarlak was talking about.